Welcome to the New Books in Art channel of the New Books Network podcast. My name is Kirsten Ellsworth, and today we are going to be speaking with Lauren Lessing and Elizabeth Finch, who are curators involved with an exhibition of folk art, A Usable Past, American Folk Art at the Colby College Museum of Art. The catalog was published hot off the press 2017. And I would like to start our conversation today by asking Lauren and Beth to introduce themselves and also talk about the motivation for the exhibition.
Thanks so much. I'm Lauren Lessing. I'm the Merkin Director of Academic and Public Programs here at the Colby College Museum of Art.
And also happy to be with you, Kirsten. My name is Beth Finch, and I'm the Lender Curator of American Art at the Colby Museum.
And what brought about this wonderful exhibition of folk art from your collections?
Well, interestingly enough, folk art was the founding collection at the museum. So we're a fairly young museum for an American museum. We were founded in 1959. So we kind of missed the first great wave of museum building in the United States by about 60 or 70 years. And at that time, there was some discussion at Colby College about what kind of an art collection would be suitable for a liberal arts college and in New England, and American folk art was singled out. We were also the beneficiaries of the generosity of a married couple who, Edith and Ellerton Jetty, who they ran the Hathaway Shirt Factory in Waterville. And so they were avid collectors themselves, and folk art was their passion. And so they both went to antique shops and little auction houses all around Maine, and they also worked with dealers to build a collection. And they donated that collection to the college as the founding collection of the art museum when it was new. So it was an important collection that had been here, you know, since the beginning. We had in the last several years, you know, embarked on a project of really documenting our collection through exhibitions and catalogs. And we had published a highlights catalog in 2009 for the 50th anniversary of the museum. And that was followed in 2013 by the Lunder Collection catalog, which, you know, documented the collection of Peter and Paula Lunder, which was an amazing gift to the museum. And then a specific aspect of their collection, which is their wonderful collection of work by James Abbott McNeil Whistler, we published a catalog of that following. And so this seemed like next in line and long overdue for a treatment. So an exhibition and a catalog. And so that was a project that was actually begun by another curator, Hannah Blunt, who moved on just after having started, kind of dipped her toe into the project. She moved on to the Mount Holyoke College Art Museum. And so I picked up that project where she left off. So I have I'm actually the director of academic and public programs here, as I said, so I head the education department, but my background is in American art, so I have a PhD in American art history. I studied at Indiana University with Sarah Burns, and so it was kind of sitting on a shelf a little bit dusty, so this gave me a chance to blow the dust off and put on my Americanist hat again and work in that vein. And I have to say that I was, my co-curator in the project was Diana Tweet, who is our CATS curator here. So I really am kept pretty busy by just being the director of the education department, so I couldn't have done it by myself. I had great help from Diana and also from Beth.
I would add as well that all of those, or I think most of those publications that all of them, I think, that Lauren mentioned, are multi-author publications. So particularly for our collection books, we've established a tradition at this point of reaching out to scholars at various points in their careers, so very seasoned scholars and emerging scholars, some of whom are Colby College students or recent graduates to do new research on the collection. And I wrote a few of those entries. We all pitched in, and then there were a few additional essays. But that is something that's, I think, a distinctive characteristic of how we've gone about these collection-based projects and allowing for the collection-based projects that we organize here to provide new opportunities for scholarship. And Lauren can speak about this in greater depth, but the also new conservation. So when the works finally were presented in our galleries, many of them had been newly conserved, some of them had been newly framed, and they were really looking their best for that project. And I think that you can see that as well in the catalog, because they were photographed after all of that new work had been done to make sure they were at their best in terms of their condition and stability.
That's clearly evident in this really nicely illustrated catalog for the exhibition. And I also noted that an undergraduate had contributed one of the essays about a quilt. And I thought that really serves the educational mission of an art exhibit, right?
It does.
Yeah. It's important to have many voices involved. I was wondering.
Yes
please, Beth.
I was just going to add that to have many voices involved means that you have, and particularly new scholarship happening, you have new ideas emerging. So that's really exciting for us when that can happen, that kind of cross connections and pollination between various people contributing to a publication like this.
And with that said, maybe something new that is occurring in the book goes right back to your title. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about where a usable past, how the idea and the display of the ideas about folk art and the display of folk art have, as you point out in the book, a very interesting evolution. And maybe you could talk a little bit about perhaps some older ideas about the importance of folk art and what you seek to challenge in the exhibition.
That's a great question. Well, I took the title from Van Wyck Brooks, who is a Harvard-educated literary critic, who in the 1920s, he coined this term, a usable past, as a way of justifying an exploration of American literature in which he, got away from the Ivy League-approved, sort of polite and very European-influenced literature that he had been taught when he was a student at Harvard, and looked to create a new literary canon from works that he perceived to be more inherently American. And so he had a tremendous influence on the inward-looking movement in the 1930s and 40s, this idea that we should look to our own, we should look inward rather than outward as a way of understanding what it means to be American and try to find what is distinctive about our culture. And so I think that Edith and Ellerton Jetty as collectors were very, very influenced by this idea. And their love of American folk art, they were not alone in this. There were a lot of collectors in the field and curators who were, and writers who were, rediscovering American folk art in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and finding in it qualities that they considered to be uniquely American. And we can look back on this now, from the vantage point of almost 100 years and see this whole project as being, in many ways more about the 20s, 30s, and 40s than it was about the 19th century. But they were looking for artwork that seemed raw, that seemed powerful, that seemed less dependent on European models, that seemed untutored and honest, and they were spinning out of this a kind of vision of what it meant to be American, that was somehow, strenuous and muscular and honest and true and I almost feel like there should be some kind of anthem playing behind me, but it was tied up with very nationalist ideas about Americanness that were current during those decades.
Right, and it even, in terms of artists' engagement with that kind of material, it predates it by a few years. I think it was in the teens when the artists Hamilton Easterfield and Robert Laurent established an artist colony in Ogunquit here on the coast in southern Maine, and began to travel around with people like Kuniyoshi, eventually the not particularly there, but the Zorax became involved, very involved in collecting folk art. So they would travel around Maine and, you know, to go by their stories, essentially knock on farmhouses and ask if the family who was living there had any portraits in their attic. And they then decorated the shacks. They were fishing shacks they were using as studios during that period. So someone like Marston Hartley was there in the summer of 1917 and produced a whole group of paintings on glass that were influenced by what he was seeing in terms of American folk art and also what he had seen in Europe. In Germany, particularly. So there's, in a sense, the artist initiated this, what an important curator of this material, Holger Cahill, called the Cult of Americana. And the Jetties were really picking up on that and pursuing it, somewhat following the lead of artists, of modern American artists.
And then as I ascertained from reading your book, or your collection of essays, in 2013, we get Roberta Smith questioning what she called a segregationist approach to actually displaying folk art in a setting where you also have academic art and other kinds of art. And I'm wondering, how did you address this in the current exhibition?
Well, that's an interesting question. The exhibition itself really was organized loosely around themes, and it did, you know, it was embedded in an academic art museum where you can, you know, the exhibition was in our Jetty galleries, which are our temporary exhibition galleries, but you could, you know, walk next door to the Lunder Wing and see examples of academic 19th century and early 20th century folk art, and you could, you know, walk to an adjacent wing and see modern and contemporary works. So it was definitely placed in dialogue with work of other periods or other styles, but the show itself was organized around themes, really based around subjects like, you know, death, grief, and mourning, which was a big category of the folk art in the collection, or the Atlantic world, you know, which contained a number of ship portraits and portraits of captains and these fantastic whalebone corset stays. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yes. And I'm just picturing, unfortunately, I'm not going to see the exhibition in person, but from your conversation and from the catalog, I can just see this much richer context for work. And tied into that, I'd like to hear from you about, you've already started talking about some of the type of work in the exhibition, but there's just so many interesting stories, the puffy sleeve artist and the accomplishments. I wonder, just to give listeners a sense of the variety here of folk art.
It was a pretty wide array of folk art that was on view, and it's a wide variety that's in the exhibition. I have to say there are a lot of portraits. Portraits were very much in demand in the United States of the 19th century. They were a way of, you know, documenting individual identity before photographs became available. And so we had a lot of portraits, but it was surprising once we really looked at the collection. I was a little worried initially that it was going to be, you know, two galleries of heads and shoulders, but actually, you know, you could even break the portraits out, as you say, into silhouette portraits, which are small and intimate, versus, you know, larger portraits in oil. And we have, you know, two beautiful little pastel portraits, also portraits of children, portraits of married couples. And then, you know, we have some really wonderful genre scenes, including this kind of fabulous, what I think is a fragment of a panorama. It's painted with oil and distemper. It's a militia parade. Its origin is sort of a mystery, but I think it depicts Charleston, South Carolina, and a kind of wonderful scene of marching young soldiers kind of marching down the street to the accompaniment of military band music. We have a whole category of schoolgirl art. So these were the kinds of either watercolor paintings or theorem paintings, which were painted through stencils, or embroidery works that young ladies would have learned in girls' schools in the 19th century. Most of them deal with romantic love in one way or another. The theorem paintings don't, but many of them do. People were very interested in documenting their houses and their farms, and so, you know, the exhibition included a few farm scenes, like the old homestead at Sudbury, Massachusetts, where you can actually get the view from the road of this very neatly kept farmhouse and see in the garden, you know, how the plots were laid out. There are cabbages and carrots and turnips and tomatoes, all in their neat little rows. It also included objects, like we had a painted fireboard. These were really important for covering a fireplace and preventing drafts from blowing down into the house during the summer months when the fire wasn't kept lit. And we hung that at knee height to try to recreate the original angle at which it would have been viewed. And a fabulous quilt that had been sewn by the ancestor of a literature professor here. Actually, we had two quilts in the exhibition. One was created, as I said, by a lady who had been the ancestor of a gentleman who named Charles Bassett, who taught English here for decades. And it was a quilt that she made before she traveled out to be a young bride in what was then, you know, the Dakota Territory. She carried it with her. It was, and this was the object that, you know, as you pointed out, it was the other quilt that we had an undergraduate write about. But this was a quilt that our professor of American art, Tanya Sheehan, often teaches with, because it's a document of this woman's life up until her marriage. It includes all kinds of references to her hobbies and her interests and her passions. It would have been made probably by her family and friends working together on her trousseau. And I like to think of her, you know, making her bed out in the Dakota Territory with this memento. It was actually sewn together from all of her ball dresses and party dresses, that little fragments of them that she would have worn when she was before she became engaged and married. And we had that sort of spread out. We built a bed-like, I don't know what you would call that, a display case. It wasn't covered with glass, but a display platform for it. And then we have a kind of fabulous doll quilt that came to us from the family of another professor, a professor of music here. It had belonged to his mother. And we believe, although we don't know for sure, but we believe that it was sewn by an African-American quilter. This was a real gap in the collection. The Jetty collection was really focused mostly on New England folk art, and it didn't include any work by African-American artists that we know of. And so we filled that gap in part through the loan of this tremendously interesting doll quilt that features six African-American children standing in rows. I think it speaks to the way that the two quilts together speak to the way that African-American quilters and Anglo-American quilters were in dialogue with one another at the end of the 19th century. Because African-American quilting is often characterized by a more free form, whereas Anglo-American quilting traditions are more geometric, and those two things are reversed in these two quilts. It's the Anglo-American quilt that's more free form and improvisational, and the African-American quilt is more geometric. So I don't know, am I giving you a good sense of the scope of the collection? Beth, what am I leaving out?
I think that was a really good overview, Lauren. I would just say a couple things. One is that folk art, going back to your mention, Kirsten, of the Roberta Smith article in which she talks about the need for folk art to be integrated into the display of American collections. That's something that we've taken seriously here for some time, at least in the recent history of this institution. So when we were getting ready to install Lauren and Diana's show, we had to do lots of reorganization of our permanent collection galleries to get this project up and going. But another thing I would just add regarding the works that are illustrated in the catalog is, in addition to the many portraits, there's also portraits of places, which Lauren touched on, that relate to this history of modernism in this area. So there is one of the works that I wrote about was a cheese factory that we think was probably in New England. And, of course, cheese was a great way to feed people who were working in the mills because it was a protein that could travel safely. And also the cheese factories that started around sort of late 19th century were ways of consolidating and automating things that had happened in farm kitchens until that point. So it was one of those bits of history that was just so fun to dig into and learn about. And, cheddar cheese. And who would have thought that would be such a fascinating, and I'm forgetting his name now, but he is credited in the notes for my entry. The scholar, he of course is based in Vermont, of cheese making in the U.S., was very helpful and was able to identify the various parts of this factory and what it was representing in terms of a farmer who had just taken his fresh milk to this place where you could sell your milk and consolidate in a place that was making cheese, and was able to point out the cold house that was used for storing milk, waiting to become cheese. So also related to what was happening here in terms of industrialization in this area, which was inseparable from the cities that were fostering and nurturing the artists who would come here in the summer and knock on farm doors and ask about what a farmer and his might have in their attic of their ancestors. So there's this interconnection between these works that I think is fascinating, and the history of this area.
That's true. And in fact, it's, people look at folk art as a quaint sort of record of the American past, but it's directly linked to modernization, all of it. You know, I mean, I was really amazed at the number of objects in the show that were based on prints. And so mechanical reproduction was really important to spreading a kind of vocabulary of images that amateur artists used all across the country, whether they were in New England or in the Midwest or even in the Far West. You know, so the images were printed on trade cards, and they were printed on little bits of advertising, or they were in gift books or illustrated magazines, and they were passed from hand to hand and used and reused. There's an image, and there's a little watercolor painting probably done by a young lady in the exhibition called Puppies. And it was, it's hard to overstate how well known this image of two little terrier dogs cuddling with one another was in the middle decades of the 19th century. It was produced in every medium. It was, you can find the puppies as a hearth rug. You can find them as a watercolor. You can find them in innumerable pieces of needlepoint. They're worked into quilts. You know, they show up as drawings. So all of that relied on industrialization, and it relied on the ability to mechanically reproduce images.
Such an array of impulses here: documentarian, consumerist, quilts that are used. Do I dare ask both of you how you would ultimately define folk art, having put on this exhibition and studied so intensely these examples?
Oh, it's really hard. And in fact, you know, I mean, throughout the process of creating the checklist, we had to wrestle with one object after another to try to decide, is it too academic? I mean, a big part of this has to do with whether the artist was had academic training, or whether he or she was trained instead through a system of apprenticeship, you know, rather than in a formal school. That was part of what we took into account when we thought about what differentiated folk art from fine art. But it's really slippery, and you know, like an example would be Charles Peel Polk's Portrait of George Washington. This is an artist who studied with his uncle, Charles Wilson Peel. Charles Wilson Peel is not considered a folk artist, so what makes Polk a folk artist when his teacher was not? You know, at the end of the day, I admit that a lot of this was subjective, and I think ultimately has to be. Beth, you want to chime
in? Yes. I would just say that in the research that I did when I was working on this, that the problem of what to call folk art or how to refer to it has been ongoing. So in the correspondence related to the gift that Edith and Ellerton Jetty gave to Colby, it was the American Heritage Collection, as Lauren has mentioned, but they frequently referred to it as well as American primitives. That was another term that you see quite a bit. And then there was an important exhibition that Holger Cahill, this forward-thinking, interesting curator, or forward and backward-thinking, I guess. He was based at the Newark Museum for many years, but in 1932, he organized an exhibition at the newly established Museum of Modern Art called Art of the Common Man in America. So there was also class issues that are engaged in this, and sometimes class assumptions, I think. So particularly, you know, let's face it, if you knock on someone's farmhouse door and he or she sells you a painting and you neglect to take down all the information. I mean, I think at the time, the reasons that the work was being collected for because of what it looked like and what it could perhaps represent. So this idea of a usable past, Lauren, I think I remember in your introduction to the book, you talk about how Van Wyck Brooks wrote about how a usable past could, in a sense, was related to collecting itself. That somehow all these various identities could be repurposed, and sometimes they could be repurposed not necessarily consciously inappropriate ways, but that the lack of information about the artworks was sometimes useful, because then they could be repurposed more freely. I think, does that make sense? I hope.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think it's interesting because Van Wyck Brooks, in that original quote, which I misspoke, it's not the 20s, it's 1918 that he made that, when he said, you know, he's searching for a usable past. He actually used a metaphor of collecting. He's like, you know, I'm going to search through the dusty attic and find, you know, so it was almost as if he was laying it out for people who would go in search of material culture and visual culture in his wake. And a lot of these collectors, and the Jettys are no exception, they were busy trying to build an American identity for themselves. So Edith Jetty was born in Belgium, I believe, and Ellerton is the, you know, son of French Canadians. And so they were both, I think, really fascinated by American identity, and they were very proud to be Americans, and they were trying to figure out what that meant for two people from immigrant families. And they kind of assembled a highly mythologized American past from this collection of sort of cherry-picked art gathered from all around New England. And it wasn't as if museums were really doing anything different. You know, they were gathering together a story about the American past in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s from this assemblage of objects, some of which were utilitarian, others were, you know, purely decorative, and some of which, you know, were intended to kind of emulate the styles of academic art.
Right, and I would just add to that this that the Jettys were collecting, well, their gift happened, I think, prior to the establishment of the museum in 59, but it was a post-World War II gift, and it was initially, those works were initially designated to actually appear in the women's dormitories here and dining hall. So I found there was a wonderful story to be told around this narrative of individualism and sort of self-reliance and around the shifting perspectives on women on campus here. So I felt that buried in this story of this gift to the college was a kind of feminist narrative. And ultimately they did, the artworks did enter the museum later and were here on site rather than in the collection, but we still meet Colby graduates, alumni who remember the artworks that would stare down from them as they were eating dinner.
I found that one of the most intriguing parts of the book, imagining the students living with the works of art in the dormitories, as you're saying, and also in terms of identity formation and nationalization, I guess you could say, you really do feature many women artists in this collection. And I wonder, in the history of folk art, which is very broadly understood, the role of women, would you say there are, I don't want to skip, majority artists are probably women, or how do we assess the role of the woman artist in the folk art story?
Well, I would just say they're not the majority. It certainly depends. It's medium specific to some extent. You know, there are areas like needlepoint where women do predominate. They were not, in general, the itinerant portrait painters. I mean, that was a job that required the painter to be on the road by himself for a good part of the year, and it wouldn't have been considered a safe or appropriate profession for a woman. But taken together, when you think broadly about what's encompassed in the term folk art, you know, women are really well represented, and they represent about half of the field. And I think that reflects a moment in time when academic art was still largely closed to women, really until the end of the 19th century, because they couldn't enroll in art academies. They were shut out of avenues for into professional art work. And so, but you know, traditions like quilting and needlepoint, they were passed down from mother to daughter. They were taught in girls' schools. And so those forms of creativity were open to women. And women, of course, were encouraged to decorate their homes and, you know, create beauty within that sphere. And so that was part of what it meant to be an educated lady in the 19th century, to be able to make certain forms of art. And Kristen, I apologize. I'm going to have to peel off here and leave it and leave the rest of this interview in the capable hands of my colleague,
well,
Beth. We have another. But this was fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much for your participation. And I would like to reiterate to everyone that Lauren and Beth's book is available. And also, if you happen to be near Waterville, Maine, you can see the exhibition through January 8th, if I'm correct.
No, I should correct you. So this was our exhibition last summer. This current summer, through November 12th, we have the exhibition Marston Hartley's Maine on
right, okay.
view. So if you do visit us, there are many works of our folk art collection that have been returned to our Maine collection galleries.
Okay, so you can see it all, as they say, right? Well, Beth, since we might have another moment with you, any future projects, or you've already told us that about the Marston Hartley exhibition. Where would you like to go after this study of folk art and all of your research? Do you want to continue with the subject, or?
Well, I am lucky and that I am able to work both with contemporary artists and also with historical material. So, you know, I have various projects always in development and always have something I'm researching here, which is, you know, it's wonderful and it's great to be at an institution where we are working directly with students and faculty. So there's, you know, having just opened the Marston Hartley exhibition that is on view now, I'm sort of in the process of getting a number of projects up and running, and in the meantime, just enjoying that current exhibition.
It sounds like busy enough, correct?
Yeah.
Well, I would like to thank you so much for enlightening us about folk art and the exhibition that was based on the Jetty donation largely to the Colby College. And I'd just like to remind everyone that the title of the book is A Usable Past, American Folk Art at the Colby College Museum of Art. And you got to listen to two of the curators speak. There are some other essays and there are entries by a wide range of people. And this book is 2017. It is the, I would say, it is the state-of-the-art treatment of kind of a new way of looking at folk art. And again, thank you very much for listening. And thank you to our guests.